First, in the second part of From the Band to the Booker, the writer Val McDermid continues her history of the lesbian novel, exploring how books with a lesbian theme moved out of the margins and into the mainstream, garnering huge sales and literary prizes along the way.
Our lips shouldn't touch.
Move over, darling.
I like it too much.
Welcome to the 1950s. Baby boom and happy housewives. But there was another world, and one whose rules were changing. 21 years after its dramatic trial and ban, Radcliffe Hall's The Well of Loneliness was republished, and only a year later in 1950, a book called Women's Barracks appeared. It sold an astonishing 4 million copies and kick-started a whole new genre, lesbian pulp fiction.
'Cause I want you right now.
Clearly, there was an audience for something. Anything that reflected lesbian lives. During the 1950s and 60s, books flooded in from America. They were famous for their lurid covers, which have resurfaced on the internet as virtual postcards you can send to your chums. The titles say it all.
Adam and Two Eves, a novel that speaks out boldly on a taboo subject.
The Doctor and the Dyke. His beautiful receptionist had a problem. Lesbianism.
Lesbian nurse. Beneath her calm efficiency raged fires of perverted lust.
Voluptuous voyage. They were a ship of sinners who left their morals at the pier.
And though it's not right, I'm too weak to fight it somehow. 'Cause I want you right.
We like reading sexy books, but it's just because we want to read about sex. It was very, very simple.
Make love to me.
The writer, Patricia Dunker, got her hands on copies of the books when she was at school. I remember as a teenager seeing them in the less highbrow second-hand bookshops of Edinburgh. I was far too well brought up to dare bring any home, though. Back then they were seen as trashy, tawdry, definitely a bit mucky. But now we've come full circle, and they're the subject of serious academic study. Dr. Kay Mitchell is lecturer in contemporary literature at Manchester University. She and Patricia Dunker give talks on lesbian pulp.
I suppose in some ways they're so bad, they're good.
One of the things that women were arguing for then, I know this sounds fantastic now, but you just have to think back into Jurassic Park, was the right to have pleasure. Hmm. And one of the things that came through these novels in spades was that being a woman was sexy. And just being a woman being sexy and having agency and being able to choose, and being able to pick someone up, and being able to choose your partner and go for her. Just that was liberating enough.
And that is what is so interesting about pulp, because they're very sexual books, and although in some ways, particularly the ones from the 1950s, are not particularly explicit, I mean, they, you know, women are sort of panting and grasping at each other, but they don't really describe what exactly they're doing. By the 60s, they become a lot more explicit, but even the early 1950s ones, they're sort of suffused with passion and intensity, and that allowed women to experience that kind of passion. You know, you read them and your heart pounds. They're meant to have a kind of physical effect on you, and that was what was so extraordinary about them, and in some ways unprecedented.
I was in my 20s, and a feminist by the time I actually read any lesbian pulp. Even from that perspective, I could feel their power to stir. But the politics of these books were still uncomfortably close to The Well of Loneliness. Part of the reason was the writers. The pulps were written by men as well as women, and the women were as likely to be heterosexual as lesbian. And of course, the publishers clearly believed that there was no market for books where the heroine could end up happy and successful and lesbian. The heroine of the pulps usually ended up dead, married, or committed to an insane asylum. One writer who bucked the trend ended up as the most celebrated lesbian pulp writer of the period. Anne Bannan was unusual in more than one way. Not only did her heroines avoid coming to a bad end, but her books were also rather well written.
I was a bride, unfortunately, so I had a little time while my husband was working, and I sat down at an old portable typewriter that was on the dining room table and launched into the book that became, ultimately, Odd Girl Out.
You were a bride, and yet you found yourself drawn to lesbian romance.
We all make a few false turns in life.
Were you aware when you started writing this book that perhaps you were not cut out to be the perfect bride of the 1950s?
It came to me, yes, in sort of a blinding flash, I think, on my wedding night.
Anne Bannon is probably the best of the lesbian pulp authors.
Do say a bit about Bebo Brinker.
Oh, yes. Well, Bebo Brinker is, I suppose, Anne Bannon's most famous character, the legendary butch of Greenwich Village, who arrives sort of timidly one day and is very uncomfortable in her masculinity, but who becomes this literally towering figure in the village, striding around, breaking femmes' hearts, yes, and drinking and occasionally becoming violent.
And sometimes going off to clubs in New York.
It didn't matter to the sophisticated girls judging her now that she was a country girl fresh from the hay fields of Wisconsin, or that she had never made love to a woman before in her life. They didn't know that and wouldn't have believed it anyway. Bebo recognized quickly that she had to start acting the way she looked. She had established a mood of expectation about herself, and now it was time to come across. The music played on. It was Bebo's turn. The match she held was burning near her finger, and because she had to do something about it, and all the eyes on her, she turned to the girl beside her and held out the match. "Blow," she said simply, and the girl, with a smile, blew.
They've got a bit of bounce to them, haven't they? It's terribly good. I mean, it's more than straightforward realism. You know, it does have a flair to it.
It might come as a surprise to readers familiar with Jeanette Winterson's intellectual essays on culture, but she is one of those who think Anne Bannon's work is a cut above the rest.
I think she's a much better writer than Redcliffe or Anne Bannon. But of course she got stacked away into the pulp fiction category, where probably she doesn't belong. I think actually she's better than that.
You would put them in between a box of Kleenex and a box of Kotex and a couple of copies of A Cops and Robbers Story. And then you would take them up to the counter, and the only thing you had to worry about at that point was whether or not the clerk knew your mother and father and would give them a call and say, "Guess what your daughter just bought?"
This is my little pulp collection over here. You see, look, I've got Warped, The Story of Two Tormented Sisters in a Strange and Terrible Triangle. That's good, isn't it?
Sarah Waters, who's been nominated twice for the Booker Prize with Fingersmith and The Night Watch, took me up to her attic and showed me her pulp collection with all the relish of a true aficionado.
Triangle of Sin, that looks good. About three lovely girls who shared forbidden ecstasies and a man who meant to show them that his kind of love was best.
Oh, of While women may have found the covers objectionable, it's certainly not what they would have chosen. They quickly learned that if there were two beautiful women, and one had a blonde hair and one was brunette, and they were eyeing each other or sidling up to each other, and there were code words like twilight and shadows and secret and evil somewhere either in the title or in the cover blurb, that they had struck gold. And
so the women, so everybody... women read, learned to read the code. If it said, "I am in love with a woman, must society reject me?" They knew they were in for a good time.
they knew they were in for a good time.
Strange breed.
A touching story of that breed of women who receive from each other what they cannot receive from men. Wow. Look at that lovely back she's got on the front there.
And what is it about these books that draws you to them in particular, Sarah?
Well, apart from the gorgeous cover work. And it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, having been so excited about 80s lesbian fiction when I was coming out, I don't want to read that anymore. What I'm really drawn to these days is the sort of pulpy, kitschy stuff. But, of course, it's a luxury, isn't it? We can only do that. We can only go back to novels like Strange Breed and Women's Barracks with a sense of fun, because we are in the luxurious position of feeling, you know, quite pretty, sort of competent and relaxed about our own lesbian identity. I mean, even and actually some of these, Valerie Taylor, Journey to Fulfillment, you know.
A novel of lesbian love.
Yeah, but they were really important in their day, and not all of them, I think, were sensational. You know, lots of things like, what was the Patricia Highsmith, The Price of Salt.
The Price of Salt,
that was the first novel, I think, with an upbeat lesbian ending. That's a great, great novel. Mm. I still love that novel.
Carol was a quarter of an hour late. Therese sat waiting for her at a table where she could see the glass doors that led into the bar, and finally she saw Carol push open one of the doors, and the tension broke in her with a small, dull ache. Carol wore the same fur coat, the same black suede pumps she had worn the day Therese first saw her, but now a red scarf set off the blonde, lifted head. She saw Carol's face, thinner now, alter with surprise, with a little smile, as Carol caught sight of her. "Hello," Therese said.
I've read it more than once. I've read it a few times because I think it's truly moving. And again, sensitive and wide open book in that it takes you places, it makes you think about things. I can't believe that anybody reading that wouldn't be moved by it or find something in there which spoke to their own life, however far away from the story.
The Price of Salt was published in 1953 under the pseudonym Claire Morgan. Years later, Claire Morgan was outed as Patricia Highsmith, author of Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley. Highsmith was recently chosen by The Times as the finest of all crime writers. For Jeanette Winterson, The Price of Salt is a highly regarded favourite.
I think it deals with all of the pain, the conflict, the difficulty, but also it has such a positive ending. You know, it doesn't have a fake Hollywood happy ending, but it has a positive ending about people being able to go forward into their lives.
This was Patricia Highsmith's second novel, following Strangers on a Train.
Lillian Faderman is the author of Chloe Plus Olivia, an anthology of lesbian literature from the 17th century to the present.
She had actually thought to publish this novel under her own name. Her editor understood that she, as Patricia Highsmith, could have a major mainstream success. And so Patricia Highsmith went along with the editor's insistence, and The Price of Salt, or Carol as it is in Great Britain, came out under the name of Claire Morgan.
In 1957, Lord Wolfenden published his famous report on morality, advocating the decriminalisation of male homosexuality. It sparked off a plethora of factual writing about homosexuality. Academics, journalists and commentators studied the report, analysed it, dissected it and fretted about its implications for British society.
I got a bit tired of this constant attention being focused on our brothers, as it were. So I thought that I would produce a non-fiction book about women, and my agent began trying to find a publisher for it.
Maureen Duffy was already a successful novelist by the time she decided to publish a factual study of lesbians. This project would eventually be transformed into one of the defining lesbian novels of the 1960s, the critically acclaimed Microcosm.
We were told that because I was not a sociologist, nobody would publish it because it would have no credibility. Eventually, I went to see another publisher who was interested, and he said, "Nobody will let you do this. Why don't you turn it into a novel?"
Beside us, a couple are already lost, eyes closed, his mouth against her neck, arms binding each other tight. And who can say whether it's the prelude to a one-night stand, a brief affair or a years-old marriage? I no longer judge. Her hands around his neck. Fingers tangle in his hair. Hips move against each other.
Maureen Duffy is owed a huge debt by all of us. She's a writer who was so bravely experimental. She's the first writer I can think of who used characters whose gender you couldn't tell, which meant that the gender was open, and gender was open for the first time.
This ambiguity of gender is something Ali Smith, the author of Booker-nominated novels such as Hotel World and The Accidental, seizes upon in her own work.
You know, these are the, if you like, the pinpoints for me of potential.
It was a break from the pre-war novels, which had mainly dealt with upper and middle class women. This was intentionally a whole spectrum of women, hairdressers, teachers, people running nursing homes, petrol pump attendants. So in its spread, it was quite different.
The march was organised by the Women's Liberation.
I think the rise of the women's movement comes into its own in relation to lesbian writing, predominantly actually in the 1970s rather than in the 1960s.
Professor Gabrielle Griffin from York University is the author of Who's Who in Lesbian and Gay Writing.
But what we are beginning to see is a certain sort of affluence amongst younger populations and a drift towards the cities. If you think about some of the popular fiction that is written in the 50s and 60s, what it's characterized by is young women going to the city, leaving small towns to make a new and independent life. And this fosters the opportunity to explore lesbian identity.
The work of these fledgling writers would have come to nothing without the emergence of independent feminist publishing houses in the 1980s. Publishers like Virago, the Women's Press and Sheba provided a unique outlet for new voices and challenging new ideas.
Looking around here in your office where you work, I see all the familiar, you know, spines of the Women's Press, the familiar black and white spines, and I remember that explosion that happened when the feminist presses started to publish in the mid and late 80s, and when I first started to publish myself. And looking back at it now, it seems to me that a lot of the writing was quite patchy. There was good stuff and there was stuff that was, let's face it, not so good. I mean, did you ever feel frustrated as a reader? That sense of almost, we should be grateful to have anything.
Yes, I did. I mean, there was the excitement that kept me reading, but it was frustrating that the standard was not great, and it all felt a bit, you know, it all felt a bit homegrown and a bit homely, really, I suppose, and a bit like if a lesbian had something to say, it would get published, you know, it would be read, because the lesbian community was so desperate, I think, for lesbian representation. We would pretty much read anything, and I think that did keep the standard of lesbian writing pretty low, didn't it?
There was an entire genre of books that seemed to me to be written by lesbian women, published by lesbian women, for lesbian women.
Manda Scott is the author of the best-selling Boudicca Quartet of novels, as well as The Crystal Skull. What she saw as the dire state of lesbian writing encouraged her to have a go herself.
They were almost exclusively about the angst of discovering sexuality or existing known lesbian person, usually butch dyke, seduces beautiful straight woman, to the great angst of everybody concerned, almost falls out, and then they find themselves happily together ever after at the end. And there's a limit to how much of that kind of crap you want to read, really. And I reached that limit very fast. At the end of it, I got to the point of thinking, well, if I can't write better than this, I could give up. I hadn't written anything, I have to say, at that point, but it did inspire me to think, well, if they can get published, I really ought to be able to follow that.
Despite the fact that the number of writers writing lesbian and gay texts began to rise significantly, mainstream presses were to some extent still reluctant to publish more than a certain quota. We've done our lesbian for the year, whereas of course only Women Press, Sheba Collective and all those sorts of presses, or Daughters Inc. in the United States, were completely dedicated to the publication of women's writing. What we can see is sometimes that books that are published by these small presses in the first instance then migrate to, say, Penguin once it becomes clear that they are widely received. But without these presses, it would have taken a lot longer to get lesbian writing into a sort of place of prominence.
For me, it really wasn't until Jeanette Winterson came along. You know, I mean, her books were like a revelation. Suddenly, lesbian fiction could be about lesbians and also be really good writing too.
Mm. It was one of those moments that where everything changes, certainly for I think British lesbian fiction. Once Oranges had been published, there was that sense of almost relief that we could find a voice that was also a voice that we could point to with pride and say, this isn't just worth reading because it's a lesbian novel, this is worth reading because it's extraordinary writing.
When I reached Melanie's, it was getting dark. I had to cut through the churchyard to get there. And sometimes I'd steal her a bunch of flowers from the new graves. She was always pleased, but then I never told her where they came from. She asked me if I wanted to stay overnight because her mum was away and she didn't like being in the house on her own. I said I'd ring a neighbour, and after much trouble finally got an agreement from my mother, who had to be fetched from her lettuces. We read the Bible as usual and then told each other how glad we were that the Lord had brought us together.
Jeanette Winterson herself rebels against the label lesbian fiction or lesbian writer. She refuses to be limited by the pigeonholes other people try to stuff her into.
There was a lot of hostility in 1985 when I started, and I do think I paid the price often from the media and in my personal life. You know, I left London in 1994 because I could no longer stand the intrusion of people endlessly wanting to talk about who I was going to bed with or focusing always in interviews on that side of things. I remember once having to do, there was a Bloomsbury did a writer's biography, and my first line was, you know, Jeanette Winston fell in love with another girl when she was 16. I found that deeply offensive, not because I mind falling in love with another girl at 16, but because I thought that isn't the way to start a serious biography about somebody who is a serious writer. Again, it's about sexuality and about putting somebody in a box so that they can't possibly break out and do other things. It's so boring. It's so boring. I know that most heterosexuals don't spend their days and nights thinking about the fact that, oh, I'm a heterosexual. Nobody I know who's gay wants to spend their days and nights thinking, oh, God, I'm gay. You know, we need to do the political work because there's been a whole civil rights issue here, which has been absolutely necessary. But from my point of view, the sooner we can forget about it all and just get on with the bigger picture, the better.
At the same time as I want my books to be read by as many different people as possible, and I want all sorts of people to be able to identify with the characters and their predicaments in my stories. At the same time, you know, I kind of think, well, yes, but I am writing about lesbian characters too, and I want to hang on to the specificity of lesbian experience. I'd never want that to get lost, you know. I mean, people can say, oh, I'm reading this lesbian novel, but really it's just a universal story of sort of love and loss. And I sort of think, well, yes, but at the same time, no, hang on a minute. I mean, with a novel like The Night Watch, for example, of mine, set in the 40s, my lesbian characters at that time would have very specific experiences because they're lesbian. And I want to hang on to that too. Do you know what I mean? The specifics of gay historical experience.
Mickey shrugged. She was only at the garage, really, because it was one of the few places a woman could work and wear trousers. She had to have some sort of job. She didn't, like Kay, have a wealthy family behind her, an income of her own. She'd begun to think, she told Kay now, of trying for a post as a chauffeur. She liked the idea of driving again and of getting out of London. They talked this over while they smoked.
Do you think that that television has had an influence in widening the audience for your own books?
Oh, yes, it's had an enormous impact. I mean, TV, I think, you know, best-selling books are read by, you know, a few hundred thousand people at best. Television is sort of injected into the people's living rooms, millions of people's living rooms across the country, isn't it? And even if people don't watch it, they're aware of what's on. There's a sort of buzz, a cultural buzz around TV programmes sometimes. And, you know, a bit of that happened with Tipping the Velvet with me in 2002, and that had an enormous impact on my career and on the sales of the books, you know, which rocketed after it was on TV.
When she walks on stage, she makes me want to smile and weep at once. I never, ever saw a girl like her before. I never knew that there were girls like her.
Suddenly, you know, I found that my name was known even by people who hadn't read my books, for example, which is quite a weird shift. You must be kind of conscious of that as well. Mm. But
I am the bloodthirsty lesbian.
You're the people that women warn their children
Absolutely.
Against.
Absolutely. It was always my ambition to attain that status. I think I finally made it.
So what has changed? What has drawn the general reading public, Virginia Woolf's common reader, to books that refuse to apologise for their characters' choices? It can't simply be that the books are better written than they were in the past. Maureen Duffy and Patricia Highsmith give the lie to that. Me, I think it's got something to do with critical mass. Not just that there is good lesbian writing out there, but that there is so much of it, it's impossible to ignore. Section 28 was passed into law in a bid to shut us up, but it had the opposite effect. They wanted to take gay issues off the agenda, but we'd come too far to let that happen to us. Gay people were mobilised, a whole generation politicised. History shows that our determination to be heard overcame their refusal to listen. So all these terrific books started to appear, and the curious readers began to pick them up, and the word of mouth started to spread. At the same time, gay began to become cool. Queer as Folk became a surprise hit for Channel 4, and as Dr. Gabrielle Griffin points out, it wasn't just TV or political protest that made sexual ambiguity trendy. Adverts and magazines were quick to jump on the bandwagon.
I think the most famous examples, perhaps, of this are the Gaultier advertisements for perfume for women. If you look at those advertisements, they're incredibly camp. They produce androgynous figures as sort of sailors. A much earlier version is the portrayal of Katie Lang being shaved by Cindy Crawford on the front cover of Vanity Fair. You're the cutest thing I ever did see. What this means is that there is a sort of public representation of the possibility of lesbianism or same-sex desire in ways that it simply didn't exist, say, 20 years ago.
I think it's clear that there has been an explosion in what you could loosely term mainstream lesbian writing in the last few years. I mean, writing that's being written by lesbians but is being read by everybody. It's a complete crossover of readership. Do you have any theories as to why that is?
I know I get asked this a lot. I mean, I certainly never, ever expected that my own lesbian novels would find a mainstream audience, although that's partly because I never imagined they would find, you know, any audience at all, really. I think there's been a shift in people's perceptions of what constitutes English literature, actually, British literature in the past few years. So it's not only lesbian and gay voices that have been welcomed into the mainstream. You know, it's a sort of range of ethnic voices. I mean, you think, you know, my novels, Ali Smith's novels, have gone into the mainstream at the same time as novels like Brick Lane and White Teeth have. You know, I think there's been an opening up of British culture and a relaxing of British society. Let's face it, you know, our novels have done well at the same time as we've made legal gains. You know, civil partnerships have come along. There's been a bit of a sea change, I think, that would have been unimaginable, wouldn't it? Sort of even 10 years ago, I think.
In the end, you know, a book's a good book because of how it's written and what its ideas are and what its images are and whether it stays with you. My whole aim has really been about bringing lesbian and gay people into the mainstream of life, not finding a way that where we can live a bit more cheerfully on the margins. You know, I don't want a world that's just full of lesbian and gay people any more than I want a world that's full of straight people. I want us all to be able to live in that place, learn from each other, but then get on with our lives, which in my case means writing good books.
And nobody can deny that Jeanette's not the only lesbian who's doing that. And in the process, writing fiction that's hugely enjoyable to read. And maybe that's part of the answer. Maybe our present success also has something to do with escaping from the weight of misery that was at the heart of The Well of Loneliness, the tradition Radcliffe Hall established of writing about crippled and damaged lives. We've left that behind us now. We've walked out into the sun and found a way to communicate our wider experience. We lesbian writers are much less obsessed with and defined by our sexuality than the straight world might think. Anyone who's human can enjoy our work. If you're a woman, there are aspects of our novels that may speak more clearly and deeply to you. And if you're a lesbian, well, that's just a bonus, really.
And my secret love's no secret anymore.
From the band, The Booker was presented by Val McDermid, and the programme was produced in Manchester by Nicola Swords.